This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It is my delight today to be able to introduce to you Eric Richards. When I was back starting my baby steps into history, into Irish-Australian history or simply colonial Australian history, Eric was one of the people who was furiously supportive to me. He probably doesn't even remember me back that far, but in the early 70s. And during that period, Eric convened three immigration seminars at the Research School of Social Sciences at ANU, which is where Richard ultimately also had done his PhD. So people help us by being encouraging way back then, and I used to sit in those in terror that he might look at me or something. And so finally it's really nice to be able to be sitting among your peers. And it's really people like Eric who have helped us all the way through with that. And Eric has been working in all aspects of immigration, population statistics, mainly based in Adelaide since the 1960s. And he just revealed to me something that he also has in common with Richard. And since, oh no, Richard's not quite gone, but I can say it. They both came to Australia as 10-pound poms. A modern immigration scheme. So I hand over to you, Eric Richards. Thanks, Eric.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Perry, for those memories. And to Richard for inviting me or inciting me here to talk in a slightly contrary fashion about the Irish emigrants in colonial Australia. So it's a great pleasure and privilege to be here on this occasion. Now, my credentials for talking about the Irish in colonial Australia are rather thin, and I'll have to try and make a virtue of that. And here I'm assisted by the Melbourne historian, Inga Clendinnen, who is very helpful on such tricky historical questions as I'm raising. And she declared a few years ago that people should be forbidden to work on the history of their own country, that Australian history ought to be handed over to, say, Ethiopians or Serbs. So it's in a sort of Ethiopian spirit that I'm approaching the subject of the Irish emigrant in colonial Australia. I think my old father would probably say that sounds a bit Irish. But I want to start very positively, as an historian of migration, by affirming that the Irish were have incontestable claims to be exceptional and have exceptional status in the world of international migration. They were at the top of the league table of most of the 19th century immigration story and were disproportionately represented in Australia, perhaps here more than anywhere else. They were, of course, as we all know, foundation people in these colonies. But these special Irish features can be overdone, and the whole notion of Irish particularity has been subjected to satirical scepticism by that well-known Canadian iconoclast Donald Akenson, who has directly challenged the assumption of Irish exceptionalism. I suspect that despite Akenson's mockery, the scepticism has been diminishing in the past decade or so. There's been a growing concentration on matters of national celebration, especially of diasporic celebration. As we all know, there are theorists of the diaspora. And it's certainly not confined to the Irish and to Irish history, but the Irish do it best of all and with most conviction, and as this conference and exhibition yet again perfectly exemplify. So the way we set up our studies necessarily amplifies the sense of contrast, the old assertion of vive la différence in historical studies, and I think that we have that here in this context yet again. The approach connects with the widespread focus on national and ethnic identity, as well as the who-do-you-think-you-are approach to the past. The pursuit of identity and its beguiling forms of construction is now rampant in historical studies, and it feeds patriotism and nationalism, as well as the mighty mills of nostalgia, genealogy, and family history. In Scotland, it, for instance, is often associated with a search for rather tragic dimensions, tragic origins, preferably with a palpable connection with the Highlands and with Culloden, and especially the Highland clearances. This is the Scottish parallel with the Irish concentration on the famine and on English oppression and a good deal of talk about victimology and the hemorrhaging by way of emigration. Now, the pursuit of national identity and the essence of Scottishness or Irishness has generated some very valuable historical research, and it can yield extremely precise historical evidence about individuals and families, and a type of microhistory supplying enormous appetite for the rediscovery of identity, and brings consolation and delight to our present generation. And I have admiration for much of this sort of work, the delving into individual stories, the quest for family connections, stretching deep into many generations of historical change. It's as an adjunct of heritage tourism, of course, or what Roy Foster has called misery tourism, especially widespread in Ireland. I suspect that the much-neglected emigre English will begin to feel a sense of envy about much of this and will soon begin to reconstruct themselves as victims of the enclosure movement and of the Industrial Revolution and of the dark satanic mills. And perhaps this will eventually invest even the English with a greater dignity as emigrants and boost their own tourist trade and their roots heritage searches. Well, my argument is that these tendencies are nourishing the great god of exceptionalism. The quest for identity is a powerful fuel in nationalism and sectarianism, and it carries its own hazards, and historians have become a bit uncritical of what they are doing, very often it seems to me. Moreover, they insist on the unique and the special experience, to the point at which the common experience is lost or regarded as insignificant. They tend to exaggerate difference and then neglect connections and the overlapping experiences of the component elements of the bigger picture of which they were part. So these forces of identity and national celebration are forces of what I would tend to regard as the balkanization of history, especially in the study of migration, my speciality. They obscure the larger elements and especially obscure the commonalities in the story. So I am therefore what I would have to call an identity skeptic, less and less convinced that this is a good use of historians' effort and investment. So I want to talk about some anti-balkanizing possibilities to pit against this identity-driven and celebratory history of our times. And paradoxically, though I'm trying to rather decrying the obsession with identity, I am more than ever in quest of roots, Irish roots in particular. I want to return to these notions when I come to the last part of my paper in a little while's time. Concern for the deepest roots, origins, determinants, ultimate causes of the great emigrations which were emitting across the Atlantic world from the late 18th century. And in this story, the Irish were prominent from the start and remained at the top of the table, as I said earlier, of per capita emigration right for a whole century or more. Meanwhile, I'm using this term sorting out in the sense of categorizing the Irish, working out their collective characteristics with the idea of fathoming their origins, role, and relationship to the receiving colonial society. Sorting out is a way of ultimately finding out what brought them across the globe in this extraordinary fashion for most of a century. So I'm looking at Irish emigrants in the receiving society of colonial Australia and the relationship between these long-distance partners in this great human exchange over that period of time. Frederick Engels, back in 1856, toured Ireland to describe it as an utterly demoralized nation, fulfilling the notorious function of now supplying England, America, and Australia with prostitutes, casual laborers, pimps, thieves, swindlers, beggars, and other rabble. Goldwin Smith in the United States a few years later in 1864 remarked that it's the Irish who have built the great part of New York. They've also constructed the railroads. They live short, he said. Another author much more recently, celebrated that the Irish laborers were the men who built Britain, in the title of it, I think. We have an Australian echo later on with Arthur Calwell, who was a great advocate, of course, of the Irish in Australia and indeed privileged his own Irish roots over his non-Irish roots, the way he presented himself. Planning the post-war immigration, he declared that Australia must avoid being a dumping ground for pommies and Cockney outcasts. We want men who are our equals, not our inferiors, he said. And Calwell said it was the Scots and the Irish who had built Australia. The English never did much of the labourers' work. And now the dams were going to be built by people from Europe, as well as from Ireland and Britain. This may have been another rhetorical flourish of Caldwell, but it uttered a prevailing view, and it's an echo of the other great claim that on behalf of the Irish immigrant in the United States and Britain. Well, I'm looking at the structural relationship between Ireland and Australia in the 19th century, the way in which they interacted and generated this quite remarkable flow of Irish humanity across the globe. And I want to ask the how and the why of that transmission and what else it related to, what else it related. Most of all, I wanted to see the Irish as part of the wider demographic system of which they were, I maintain, inherently a part. And I'm searching for degrees of complementarity and reciprocity of the migrations which poured from Ireland to Australia in the colonial period, and which, of course, terminated rather abruptly in the 20th century, or almost terminated. So it's part of this, the constituent parts of an intercontinental exchange that we're looking at between Ireland and Australia, huge migrations of people and culture and capital and much else. And, of course, the Irish, the Australian colonies drew on Ireland quite disproportionately, more so even than Scotland. And this is one of the central facts concerning the essential relationship. It meant ultimately that Australia was a much more Irish place than one would have expected, and the Irish heritage is stronger here, as evidenced by the vitality of Irish history in Australia. Now, it's been said that that Irish emigrants were unusually well-tailored for the role of servicing other people's industrial revolutions. But that's not quite the case in Australia, it seems to me. Moving to Australia was propelled in the first instance by the requirements of rural Australia, the primary industries and their needs. And for this, I'm going to argue, the Irish were best suited in terms of their background and their skills, not entirely unlike the manner in which Irish labour was servicing English and Scottish agriculture in the mid-19th century. And there were always vested interests, of course, in operation in this great interconnection between the two countries, not least amongst the emigrants themselves, who had most to gain by the exchange and most to lose in that great lottery. But whatever may have been the consequences of rural evacuation from Ireland, the landlords of Ireland were undoubtedly beneficiaries of emigration. They supported, coerced, pressured, and encouraged emigration in many well-known ways. And their motives, as always, were decidedly mixed. Economic gain, panic, humanitarianism, desperation, and opportunism amongst the landlords. Opportunity was particularly on offer in the Australian assisted migration systems, which, of course, were extremely generous through this time, assisted migration. Attractive schemes not only to prospective migrants, but also to landlords and the poor law authorities and miscellaneous charitable bodies in Ireland. The question arises very often of how much the Australian system was cynically manipulated by conniving landlords to rid themselves of unwanted population. And I'll come back to this in a short while. And that then relates to the problem of Irish poverty and population pressure. And if we accept the argument that the primary solution was the reduction of the population in relationship to resources by mid-19th century to reduce land hunger in Ireland, we are, of course, in contentious territory. But it applies, as I will argue, across the board in the British Isles, including within England and Scotland, and that Australia was offering some relief to all parts of Britain in terms of rural overpopulation, certainly in the late 19th century. Now, Irish historians and others generally recoil from the idea of a mechanical explanation of migration. It has to be said that the Irish had most to gain by emigration to Australia. Australia sustained the highest living standards and wages in the world throughout most of the 19th century, while Ireland was mired in poverty, which in many ways was worsening in the middle decades of that century, burdened by extreme population growth. We should never underestimate the sensational growth of population in Ireland between 1790 and 1845. 1.3% per annum, almost at the extreme end of any kind of population increase, and much faster than the population growth that was occurring simultaneously in England. But the growth began to slow by the 1820s and 1830s and into the 40s by various mechanisms, But Ireland remained grotesquely vulnerable to crop failure, and while Australia was extremely short of labour and population, it was able to match, the two needs were being matched, as I'm going to suggest, by the various mechanisms which were generated during that time. So it's the urgency of that relationship, to obtain labour in the colonies and to get out of Ireland, that provide the drivers of the differential recruitment in Ireland. And I'm going to argue that there's a very good fit between Ireland and Australia through those times, despite colonial resistance to the very idea of Irish immigration. Australia, I think, was beginning to recruit free immigrants from Ireland at a key time of transition in the demographic and socio-economic history of both countries. And I'm talking about the late 1830s and the early 1840s. Australia at that time was converting out of its dependence upon the supply of convicts while rapidly expanding its labour requirements in its primary industries. Its needs were becoming closely defined and now, of course, informed by a civilising mission and a theory of colonisation which dictated the sort of immigrants it was looking for, or they were looking for. There was a simultaneous transformation in Ireland, quite different. At that time, migration within and beyond Ireland was beginning to quicken quite significantly, and its 18th century concentration in the northeast of Ireland, in Ulster, was beginning to be broken. Emigration from the south and the west in the 1830s had begun to make emigration an all-Ireland phenomenon. Peasant Ireland was now mobilising for mass selective emigration before the famine, well ahead of the famine catastrophe. And these two transitions were occurring at the opposite end of the world, and they were intersecting at the end of the 1830s, is my argument. I've been surprised by some of the recent findings on the state of Ireland before the famine, which have great implications, I think, for our view of the relationship between Ireland and Australia. The idea that Ireland was failing and that it was heading inevitably towards a Malthusian disaster is now, it seems, quite misleading. Moreover, Ireland's connection with Britain was not necessarily all negative in terms of the effect on the welfare of the Irish. Land hunger was certainly rising alarmingly as the population grew, but the nutritional status of the people remained surprisingly good in those years before the famine, even though living standards were very low and the possibilities of betterment narrowing and economic security weakening and alternative employment opportunities outside our agriculture not good at all. So the situation is rather paradoxical. The Irish, on average, were growing taller, literally, and more literate, with a widening pattern of consumption before the famine. With a diet of potatoes and milk and good supplies of fuel, they were significantly and measurably taller than their English counterparts who earned better wages. Moreover, the gap between England and Ireland was maintained through those decades before the famine. This may have been a consequence of the rural life compared with the effect of industrialisation and urbanisation in England. But in Ireland, they were taller than the English. They were tallest of all in Ulster, even though Ulster was, of course, industrialising to a degree at that time. Ulster is a surprising element in this story. It seems to get the benefits of industrialisation without some of the more obvious costs in nutrition and in bodily welfare. For the rest of the West and Southern Ireland, the consequences of very rapid population growth were dire, worsening land-labour ratios, population pressure, poverty, and perhaps the end of hope. But at the same time, it was also very difficult to get out. So we now have evidence amassing that the living standards in Ireland, on average, were actually rising in Ireland before the famine from a very low base. And the evidence produced by Deborah Oxley in recent times has argued that before the famine, the Irish were becoming more literate, growing taller, consuming more exotic products than the better-off English. So this is based upon anthropometric evidence, measuring heights, and reinforced by other scholars in the field. The distribution of resources in the pre-industrial Irish family, we're told, resulted in an unusually tall population. We can see that in the army recruits. And we can see it particularly in the female part of the population. Irish women were particularly taller than their English counterparts. during the pre-famine era. And the small Irish towns did best of all, it seems. And thus the deteriorating living standards of English women contrasted with the increasing heights of Irish women over that period before the famine, population growth producing a great reservoir of emigrants. And they were told by European comparisons also during that time. They were not falling behind in nutritional status. It's a confusing picture from all these peculiar statistics, but the story is one of nutritional standards which were higher than those maintaining in England, Scotland, and Wales. And you have other regional variations, which I can't really enter into for the moment. But the implications for Australian recruiters is that they were facing, perhaps, I'm suggesting, a relatively well-fed and vigorous rural population, which is increasingly suggestible to the idea of emigration even before the famine, well-suited to Australia's needs and recruitable, notably amongst the more literate and the young. Beneath them would be a substrata of Irish society which was simply too poor for emigration, which, of course, as we all know, was a very expensive business. So in many ways, there's a possibility that these people were, in many ways, ideal for Australian labouring needs. The problem was, of course, connecting them with into their systems. But it soon became clear that Ireland was a particularly good recruiting ground for both men and women, particularly men and women who were interconnecting with the Australian systems, people who were reproductive in an astonishing rate, which is another element in the story, emigrating before the famine, drawing heavily on Ireland, particularly because it was extremely difficult to recruit in England and in Scotland at that time. So Ireland makes up for the deficits from the rest of the British Isles. We have other evidence of a similar sort, statistical sort, looking at some 15,000 or more of the migrants in 1841, the great mass migration from Ireland to Australia in 1841, very well documented, and we can look at some of the data there. At a time when Australia is beginning to recruit, late 1830s to 1840s, for free migrants in large numbers, quickly discovered that the propensity to emigrate from rural England and Scotland was inadequate. So Ireland makes up for, compensates for those deficits, even in South Australia, which is the least Irish place, but had the best image, perhaps, of any of the colonies in the late 1830s. Even South Australia was drawing disproportionately on the recruits out of Ireland. And for New South Wales in 1841, 62% of the immigrants come from Ireland, and we look at those as the supplier compensating for the reluctance of the English. Now, looking at those more than 15,000, and despite the negative publicity against the Catholic Irish peasantry coming to Australia, they are clearly the bone and sinew, to a very large extent, of that immigrant population. And on average, I would suggest, they're probably better specimens. The selective procedures were discriminating and often rather chaotic, but basic facts were shaping the process, the cost of entry, the assistance schemes, and so on. But they're becoming a very good immigrant selection. The Irish were filling the bill better than anyone else in the intakes. And more specifically, I've been looking at the literacy counts amongst those migrants, the ability to read and write, which is registered amongst that large number of people at that time, and in, of course, the later populations coming into Australia as assisted migrants. What is clear is that they are more skilled and more literate than the people from whom they are drawn, from the home populations. They are above the average of the home populations in literacy and occupational status. It suggests that the Australian colonies were creaming off the upper layers of the various strata across the British Isles, not just in Ireland, but it certainly applies to the Irish. They were consistently, uniformly, and reliably more literate than the populations of Ireland from which they were drawn. Whether they're from Tipperary or from Donegal, from Ulster or from Munster, or for that matter from Manchester, Caithness or Cornwall, we have that same consistency. They are more literate than the people they came from, and reliably so in that data. It's likely that the Australian colonies did better than other destinations, and this is a factor which we tend to ignore or downplay. And within the structural framework, the old relativities are intact. So the Scots are more literate than the English. The English are more literate than the Irish, who are at the bottom of the class. But they're still being drawn from the top echelons of the home population of each of those places. And it was not a fatal handicap. And they were, in any case, better placed than their countrymen and women at home. So my assumption is that the measures of literacy, age, skills, and so on, provide a good proxy for the overall quality of those incoming migrants. So there are two suggestive conclusions from that kind of evidence, that in the pre-famine Irish emigrants to Australia, first that they're coming from a population whose physiological, bodily condition was on average better than we thought, and secondly that the selection procedures by the people themselves and their agencies yielded a higher strata, the higher strata of the population than we expected. So the relationship was thus established. On one side, a country passing through demographic revolution, pre-industrial in structure, mobilizing itself in new forms for mass migration. This is then connected distantly with the rapidly expanding Antipodean colonial colonies, eager for working migrants, both selective and unsure of their capacity to cope with the Irish in large numbers. On average, the Irish were poorer and less well-educated and more rural than other immigrants, but they were more recruitable and adaptable to the colonial needs. So the essential reciprocity, at least a major element of it, is involved, is established in that intercontinental exchange very early in the piece. So there are particular channels emerging, and ways of sorting out the migrants is part of what we're trying to do, and particularly amongst the female population. Timothy Coghlan said that Australia resorted to Ireland to obtain strong, healthy young women willing to work, but not yet trained as servants. And he was responding to the kinds of selectivity which was being established by that time and later in the century. So immigration was expensive and highly selective, and it was being drawn from the Irish population in various different ways. Highly selective, but undecidedly not a cross-section of the Irish population, but a rural people strong in body, and the poverty was their greatest restraint and impediment. But rural labour was the top priority for the Australian colonies, and consequently special mechanisms were being developed to get them to Australia. And the profile is very distinctive, as various analysts, particularly David Fitzpatrick, has pointed out. One of the points that I want to stress further is the way in which this mechanism operated from Ireland, particularly by the remittance systems, which have been looked at in great detail. It apparently is the case that Australian migrants, Irish in particular, sent rather less remittances back to their home country, to Ireland in this case, than they did in other destinations, particularly from North America. Relatively low private remittances from Australia. And I think that the reason for this is that the remittances were channeled into the institutional systems, the official migration assistance systems that were operating by the colonies, and the Irish were particularly adept at making use of those. And so that the remittance system was channeled into the official institutionalized change of migration, which is again another great Irish achievement, which I'll emphasize again in a moment. The benefits to Australia were decisive, whatever mechanisms there were. For Ireland, there was always an argument about the loss of its people. This is true of all countries losing emigrants. The actual numbers relieved directly to Australia during the famine catastrophe were considerable but relatively small in the total movements and in terms of Ireland's total problem. Ireland's role in relieving the famine is that it widened the potential destinations and also received those who were able to escape, those with some resources at their disposal or had connections with assistance from kin and the official channels in Australia. Patrick O'Farrell declared that there were very few famine refugees in Australia. It was, in other words, still highly selective. After the famine, the recruitments were different, but still, I would suggest, very selective. Still favoured the somewhat better off, and those particularly with a nose for acquiring land amongst the migrants. After the famine, the system seems to have operated efficiently, interlocking the two ends of the connection of the transaction. And Australia, I think, particularly gathers to it people who were directly seeking the acquisition of land. The land acquisition instinct amongst the Irish, I think, is a particular aspect of the migratory story that is being told. And the unaccompanied female component of the migration systems is again another way in which the two sides interlock very effectively. And Ireland becomes the best recruiting ground to meet Australia's insatiable demand for female migrants. So migrants after the famine tend to be surplus offspring. The American demographer Timothy Guinain has demonstrated that in the evacuation of Ireland after the famine, emigration is particularly vital in this, and that the disinherited younger sons and younger daughters, too, of the families were especially suggestible in the migratory thing, and I think Australia receives a large number of those, particularly through the operation of primogeniture, as it operated in Ireland, and Australia becomes a beneficiary of that. But you'll see one of the consequences of what I'm arguing is that the famine, and the demographers tend to reinforce this, the famine becomes less vital in the story. The story of the famine mechanisms connecting the two countries both precedes and succeeds the great event itself, the great catastrophe itself, and expresses itself to a large extent in the way in which Irish have a disproportionate, differential appetite to re-establish themselves on the land, and I think that is expressed, manifested in Australia as well as in other countries. I'm rather conscious of losing time here and having to skip rather large sections, and I wanted to deal with the landlords to a degree, and particularly refer to the work of Margaret Ray's work on Eliot, which some of you may know, where she seems to find that the operations of the Colonial Land and Emigration Commissioners was a much more professional operation than we might have expected, and managed to keep the persuasions of the landlords, if we can call that, at bay, and worked very effectively in an increasingly professional way. In terms of the flow of capital and entrepreneurship to Australia from Ireland, I think that is lower than one would expect in proportional terms. And I'm arguing in my paper here that while capitalists and entrepreneurs from Ireland are underrepresented in, say, the ADB and in the books of pastoral pioneers, that's not necessarily an expression of disadvantage so much as the fact that Ireland was not generating large funds of capital and of entrepreneurship simply because it was not being industrialised through that time. And this is what one would expect. Out of Scotland, and parts of Scotland certainly, parts of England, you have the reverse story, and that is a further expression of that situation there. Similarly, I would suspect that the flow of professional people to Australia is a further further reflection of the situation back at home. At the top, I'm rather intrigued by one case which I really must tell you about because I've just been reading about the story of the appointment of a Catholic Irishman as governor of the colony of South Australia in 1861, which is rather extraordinary in itself. But Sir Dominic Daly did not obscure either his nationality or his faith. And the reception of his appointment was as chilly as one could imagine in Protestant South Australia in 1861. Euphemisms of being not of received not without prejudice or misgivings, and he came amongst us as a stranger and an alien in religious profession, and there was a flood of protesting correspondence about his appointment at that time. Unhappily, he died only 7 years later in 1868, at which time the province was rapturous in its celebration of his life and his contribution to the state, The grief at his death was extraordinary. He'd been universally revered as the most popular governor, the kindliest and the most impartial. And it was difficult for the South Australians to work out whether this was a reflection of his virtues or of their extraordinary tolerance at the time. But he's an example of the professional Irish getting a foothold in Australia, but proportionally rather lower than ordinary Irish who came by way of the mechanisms that I've been talking about. And the governmental migration schemes, which draw upon the remittance urges of the assisted migrants from Ireland particularly, and create this communal replanting of Irish folk in Australia, is a way in which Irish savings in the colonies were being channeled into the system, and indeed, I would suggest, providing a substantial financial economic contribution to the system, which we tend not to measure, actually. The way in which Irish savings within Australia subsidised further rounds of migration through the institutionalised chain migration is a very important mechanism at work. And where the Irish were disadvantaged in Australia, and I would not wish to diminish that disadvantage, it seems to me to reflect in the first instance the fact that they're coming in with lower levels of literacy, lower levels of assets than their contemporaries from England and Scotland. They're not unlike other groups in other migrant societies, say Sicilians in New York, or Indians and Filipinos in the Gulf States. People coming in at the bottom of the migrant intakes, bottom of the of society, and then having to work up their way through society from a lower level, have a longer ladder to climb up than other people. I suspect that the Irish disadvantages in Australia were not dissimilar to those faced by people, say, from the Highlands of Scotland, or from St Kilda, or from Bedfordshire. And people from Bedfordshire had the lowest level of literacy amongst all the immigrants from England, or from mainland Britain, and their efforts through colonial society would have been no different, or would have been rather similar to those that faced Irish migrants. And of course, in England itself, there were similar sorts of pressures outwards within English society to get rid of the lowest parts of society by way of emigration. There were schemes in the 1880s to educate children in London to prepare them from emigration. I have a quotation from Samuel Smith in 1885 about the corruption of urban life and how it must be relieved by emigration to the colonies in order to use the words that he used, to deodorize, so to speak, this foul humanity. He's talking about English people in London and how they should be pushed out to the colonies. And he was not alone. So the poverty question in Britain and the urban poverty question in Britain produces the same kind of outward pressure by authorities and by intellectuals in the late 18th century, particularly those dealing with agricultural labour and the endless internal migration of agricultural labour into London and into the cities, causing increasing social difficulties. And it is a broad cross-British problem. And, of course, the Irish situation is a severe and larger aspect of that same sort of pressure outwards from rural communities into urban places. I often look at this in terms of what I call a U-shaped curve to describe the typical trajectory of ordinary migrants as they experience their removal from home through the journey, through arrival and re-establishment, and then up, very slowly, up the other side of the U-shaped curve. And you can see this in the lives of many emigrants. Henry Parkes is a very good example of the downward movement before emigration and then very slowly up the other side. And it seems to me that you can see this in many cases that we look at. The severity of the fall and the rise depend upon the state and status of the immigrants on arrival. Clearly, the people who arrive as authentic refugees from the famine, whether from the Isle of Skye or from Skibbereen, were placed differently from the majority of immigrants. And you would expect the average Irish emigrants assisted to Australia to have laboured under a number of disabilities, for the reasons I've explained, particularly lower literacy, lack of capital, deeper rural backgrounds associated with a degree of also of prejudice of cultural, economic and religious variety. So literacy and poverty determine the place of the migrants in the hierarchy of esteem, and the Irish were not well placed in all of this. But their rise up the other side of the U-shaped curve, I think, is something which we discuss and argue about. The fact that there's less segregation of the Irish in late 19th century Australia perhaps is a suggestion of a relatively unimpeded upward mobility to the centre of colonial society. So I'm talking about this reciprocation between the two places, between a pre-industrial economy towards the colonial pastoral economy, the fact that they're rural people into Australia from rural Ireland who fit the needs very successfully. They have low rates of remittance home, low rates of return home because living standards are so much higher in Australia than they are elsewhere. Donald Akenson, I refer to again, wanted to use Australia as a clean laboratory, as he said, for testing the behavioural differences between Catholics and Protestants. He wants to argue that the Irish were little different from other immigrants. This was evidently not much. There was evidently not much segregation of the Irish in Australia. More inclined to marry outwards, less likely to join Irish associations and organisations than in other Irish places around the world. Indeed, perhaps facing fewer barriers to self-betterment. And they were dominated by single people, and this made them very desirable, flexible, and portable members of the colonial labour force. Well, I've been trying to connect these two countries at the far ends of the earth and the reciprocation that's going on between them, and to suggest that the Irish have a particular complementarity with Australian needs and that there are two-way benefits in both directions, which are, of course, a very complicated story if I went into it in any detail. But as I said at the start, I am most interested in what propelled emigrants around the globe. So the broad question of the general movement of people around the globe in the late 18th and early 19th century. And the Irish were the most migratory of the people of the 19th century. And, of course, they were heavily represented here in Australia. And the experience of getting to Australia and the fate of the Irish and the shaping and maintenance of their identity when they arrived here, naturally those things monopolise our attention, that experience. But I think there are certain prior questions to which I always seem to revert. Most notably, I mean the ultimate causes of emigration, of which the Irish were such dominant, central exemplars. They are interesting as migrants, I think, beyond their Irishness. Beyond their Irishness. What indeed were the fundamental forces which activated and channeled the extraordinary mass migrations, in this case, those of the Irish, and were there uniquely Irish causes in these Irish circumstances? So in this big question, in this big picture of migration, the one that I'm seeking, I'm always drawn back to the work of the great American historian Bernard Bailyn, who was here in the early 1990s, actually. And he conceptualized the problem about 20 years ago. He envisaged the intercontinental flows of migrants in the Atlantic, the great Atlantic system, in the end of the 18th century, the time when their entire mobility systems were galvanized in three continents. In a sense, it was the beginning of modern migration, and its genesis is one of the great mysteries of humanity's recent history. Bailyn talked of great tectonic shifts, of entire societies bulging and adopting new shapes, which produced these enormous extrusions of people across the globe. Much of this is couched in appropriately mystical, metaphorical language because we're not at all clear what was going on in those great shifts of people. The fundamental forces of migration, in other words. It seems to be founded in the last analysis, I suspect, on demographic movements in the deep rural foundations of Western societies. And it's these deep foundations of Western societies, and in that big picture, it's where the Irish are founding members, playing a very early and massively differential role, from the late 18th century onwards. And Australia is a distant but very small remote outlier of that much bigger story, much bigger system. And I suspect that Irish emigration was part of the broad British Isles sector of a West European system, part of the shifting elements over the period after 1780. But there was an exceptional Irish component in these bigger shifts. It was to do with the very early, indeed precocious, Irish involvement and with the scale of its contribution to the oceanic flows of which Australia was a surprisingly large shareholder. The Irish were one of the several overlapping diasporas issuing out of North and South Atlantic, and the Australian element was an expression of that elemental force which produced this extrusion of those people. So at the end, I'm really brought back to the literal roots of all this mobility, Irish roots or otherwise. And as I look for the essential origins of the great migrant movements of which the Irish were so prominent a part, I find myself retreating into the deep past, into the actual homelands, to the towns, the villages, the parishes, the farms, and to the very soil of the emigrating people of Ireland and of the British Isles, of Clonalty, of the Isle of Man, of Anglesey, of County Cork, and so on, delving into the transits out of the pre-industrial world which eventually merged into these great intercontinental flows of emigrants. This includes, of course, those who arrived in Australia from all over Ireland. And this is where the material generated from the parish level, at the who-do-you-think-you-are level, is absolutely vital, at the level at which people made probably the most important decisions of their lives, that is, the decision to emigrate. This is at the level at which the evidence of the question, why did it happen, what was going on, and why, and what were the essential transformations taking place at that time. Gary McGee and Andrew Thompson have talked us about, urged us to go beyond the rhetoric of settler identity to explore in detail the structural foundations of these great changes, and they particularly look at the Irish case and the effect of remittances in the way that that kept the systems together and produced international kinship networks and the mechanisms of migrations. But the best exponents of these dense connections are historians such as our esteemed orchestrator, Richard Reed, who asked the critical question, who they were, where they came from, and what happened to them. And he indeed tracked them back to the exact spot, the exact plots of land. And it seems to me that when we can trace many more of the individual migrants even deeper into their origins, into the soil of Ireland and elsewhere, then I think I'll be prepared to celebrate and to rejoice in the exceptional history of Irish emigrants. I'll be able to do that when we've got deep into the 18th century, perhaps, and early 19th century, to those roots at that depth, be able to celebrate identity and its exceptionality in a perfectly objective and Ethiopian spirit. And I'll leave you with that thought.
I was struck when you were speaking about the Irish as being, you know, exceptionally tall and when well fed into the 1820s and 30s, with the comparisons with other peoples in the British Isles, but also across Europe, and wondering whether some of the things you're pointing at are not so much about good things happening in Ireland as exceptionally awful things happening elsewhere. And again, movements out to colonies as not so much great, wonderful opportunities as other peoples not having those opportunities. So when I'm thinking about people in France going through the awful disruptions of revolution and rolling revolutions actually in that period, there's not the opportunity for them in the same way to go out to empire, in the same way that was possible for people in the British imperial world that's emerging at that time, in the new British imperial world, if you see what I mean. And in terms of height and physical welfare, if you look at the French, you know, they've been through all of these revolutions. The opportunity to be physically well-developed is kind of not there. In Britain, you've got rural populations moving into the awful conditions of the cities, and so they're being stunted, if you see what I mean. I think English people physically are quite stunted anyway over many centuries, but particularly from that industrial period onwards, you know. So it's not so much that the Irish are kind of going ahead and having wonderful new opportunities, but that, that they are, I wonder if they are just being kind of ordinary for that period and everyone else is being held back.
It is mystifying and paradoxical, but it does seem to be the case from the evidence that, that the Irish are taller than the English and they're taller than most people in Europe. I suspect that's a consequence of the special diet, which is said to be nutritionally very good, but rather tedious and boring, potatoes and milk. An excellent diet, apparently. But in England, there's a debate about how far the standard of living was falling in the industrialising population, and it is often put down to the consequences, the adverse consequences of industrialisation. So you have them going down and the Irish either maintaining or slightly improving, despite the sensational growth of population. So it's very paradoxical and very confusing and difficult to understand. And how that affects their propensity to emigrate, I'm not sure. I mean, the living standards in England are actually higher in terms of wages than in Ireland through this time. So another paradox. And that one suspects that it would be, in logistical terms, easier to get out of England than it would be to get out of Ireland. But the opportunities for employment are perhaps more available in England than in Ireland. And, of course, the famine itself then alters the situation very radically in the most appalling way. But after the famine, you have Irish emigration increasing at a time when living standards apparently are rising. So it's anti-Malthusian situation emerges after the famine. So how all of this affects the propensity to emigrate is very interesting and very testing in terms of providing a clear explanation. But it's terribly interesting and very important to work out what is going on to produce this galvanising of huge populations across the oceans in the way that we're talking about. So it's a very interesting question.
Sir, during the 19th century, the various famines, and on Gartha Moor, the big famine, they Liverpool, Manchester, Glasgow were up to 50% Irish. So how would you dissect the ones that came out from Britain that were ethnically Irish to Australia and the ones that came out from Ireland itself? In the coming later, Churchill said, when they were agitating for the return of the ports, he said, we'll give them the ports if they give us back Liverpool, you know. So I just wondered how you'd dissect, because there was huge Irish populations in British cities, even in London, in the 19th century.
Yes. A lot, obviously, an awful lot of Irish emigration is two- or three-step migration within Ireland and then maybe to Liverpool and then maybe within England or Scotland, and they're not on the boats to Australia or America. And it's difficult sorting them out, except where you have very good records. And I think some of the Australian records do show places of birth rather than places of last residence. So you can sort them out to that degree. But it's just technically a very difficult problem working out who is actually Irish and who is English when they all leave, or a lot of them leave from Liverpool and are not registered at all. Where they are registered in the Australian records, that's much better than in most others. Australia has some of the best emigrant letters, registers for the assisted migrants. The unassisted are practically invisible for large parts of the 19th century. Very difficult to work out, like, you know, trying to herd cats in terms of sorting out. And it's not exclusive to the 19th century. It is still extremely difficult to work out emigrant numbers and emigrant origins and emigrant destinations and who are permanent, who are temporary, and so on. In the 19th century, in some ways it's easier with our excellent Australian records, but in otherwise it's more difficult in terms of stage migrations that take place. So we treat with great scepticism all emigrant data, particularly statistical data, except some of this excellent data relating to assisted migrants, especially in the middle decades of the 19th century.
Eric, thank you for that placing of the Irish migration in the context of other migration from parts of the United Kingdom and in Europe. But I want to take you up on this thing about the matching of what comes out with what is needed here. Obviously, labour is needed, and Irish agricultural labour will fit the Australian agricultural labour needs. But once you come to the situation of the Land Acts and the idea of going onto a small farm, I'm wondering, would you give us from a reflection from your research? I'll jump away. Geoffrey Searle says it's the cruelest dream, you know, of the 19th century in Australia that people could have a small farm. There comes a point when the desires of the people coming doesn't match really the Australian economic situation in that regard. Is that making sense? And is there anything in the records and stuff you're looking at, the policymakers, that explains what happens there after the Land Acts? I mean, that's the micro studies are all showing that. All these families' histories are showing that, I don't know whether it's 8 out of 10, but a lot of the selectors fail, don't they?
Yeah.
Thanks.
I think that what one finds amongst migrants, not just Irish migrants, but amongst Cornish migrants I've been looking at recently and some Scottish migrants, is that very often they are still in the grip of a sort of rural myth or a rural dream to reinstate themselves or to gather for the first time a plot of land. And this remains a strong intuitive sense right through the 19th century, and you certainly see it in America, you see it in Australia, you see it in other places, and it, of course, has political consequences when their yearning for acquisition of land is blocked by the land monopolies, as they're called at the time, and that has enormous political repercussions in New Zealand, Australia, America, in Ireland, and, of course, in Scotland and elsewhere. And when some breakthrough is made with that, and these smallholders gain land under that dream, often it is not very viable in economic terms, as we would say these days, and it leads to a poor consequence for those fulfillment of those dreams, so that the small plots of land or the small acquisitions that they obtain eventually prove to be too small. This happens, I've been looking at the York Peninsula in South Australia recently, the great movement of smallholders onto the land in the 1870s, 80s and 90s is a great rush of people, including a lot of Irish, it should be said, and a lot of ex-miners go into the land. But not, they don't survive more than a generation or two, most of them, and eventually they're amalgamated back into large holdings. It's the end of that dream. It is a dream, and maybe it's a bit of a nightmare too for a lot of them over a generation or so.
It's a bit of a comment, Richard Herriman here. Just from reading Annie's PhD stuff about 19th century migration to the Mount Barker district, it struck me that you've got the idea that you're going to get richer because you can maybe get a plot of land and farm it. But the other thing that became really apparent is the increasing industrialisation, you know, processing of materials and the increasing opportunities of people over that century that made it so that even if a certain number of small farmers failed, there was going to be plenty of opportunity in other areas. Because I was just thinking, if all this farming business was such a drag, the information would have got back to Ireland or wherever and they wouldn't have come. In other words, there must have been some good things going on apart from farming.
Well, the growth of the cities in Australia, of course, is very peculiar because it happens. Australia becomes a very urbanised place before it becomes industrialised, effectively. It doesn't really industrialise till the 1940s. But the big cities are already disproportionately large back in the late 19th century, which presumably are operating in a sort of entrepot role, but nevertheless drawing labour into them for the servicing sector of those cities.
Oh, yes, Eric, thank you for that. I knew we'd get the stratospheric overview, Eric, and I want to thank you for that. Just to make a comment and then draw attention to something you said at the end. In terms of New South Wales anyway, I'm not going to speak about the other colonies because I didn't know the systems so well. It's not two-stage migration in relation to the Irish, you know, 1848 to 70, in assisted migration. It's coming from Ireland. The commissioners in London are quite clear about that. You know, they don't want to recruit Irish in England, and they don't do it by and large. The same with the remittance stuff. The remittance stuff is all back to Ireland. If you examine the remittance regulations and all the figures are there for that, all the individual ones, their addresses are back in Ireland, not in England, when they sponsor them. You know, they sponsor them to an address where they are living in the British Isles. Yeah, you think that's two-stage?
Intersperse. I'm saying that the remittance is back for assisted passages, not to subsidise home life in Ireland.
No. This is to bring them out here. But they're not two-stage immigrants. That's
what makes it different from American remittance.
Oh, absolutely. I'm saying they're not living in England. They're living in Ireland. Right. That's the important point. They're not two stages in relation to assisted immigrants. People who are not assisted may well be that. But the assisted ones coming from Ireland in the 1840s and 50s who are remitted are not living in England at the time. You see my point?
What about those in Liverpool?
Well, they don't get nominated to Liverpool. They get nominated to the parishes in Ireland. They're referees of the parish priests and all the various, you know, they're not living anywhere else except in Ireland. And the commissioners won't allow them to be living somewhere else if they're Irish. It's in the regulations. I can show you that stuff. Never mind. We'll leave that one for the minute. Right? It's complicated. The other thing you said, though, at the end was this business of going back to the parish level, right, and disaggregating it all the way down, as I've tried to do with Clonalty. What becomes the big question there is not so much, this thing at either end of the globe, it's rather, why does somebody decide to come in 1855 or 1858 or 1861? You can see the pattern as it emerges. And that seemed to me to be always the question I got asking. You know, they've survived there until 18. What triggers it at that moment? What triggers it in 1861? That's the complexity of the issue when you're looking at it from leaving Ireland. And that's something I didn't provide an answer to that because I didn't have the information. All I could see is I could see exactly when they're coming and from what part. So you can make certain kind of assumptions about that, but you never get to the real guts of it from an individual level.
My just very swift response to that, if I may, Perry, is that those decisions in 1855 or 59 or whatever are part of a much bigger story. I mean, this relating the micro decisions with the global situation that's occurring in terms of mass migration out of Western Europe. And it's connecting those two things, which may provide an answer to both questions. Mm.
I think there's a quick question here from Anne Heron.
Yes, okay. Just to bring in that South Australian perspective, which I think is quite different, the evidence there is that it's local demand. The 6,000 girls who came to South Australia in 1855, 56, were in response to demand, lack of labour, and the internal migration of people to the goldfields, for example, and the lack of labour there was that changed a local perception of whether they wanted immigrants from Ireland. And so you get that local thing happening at that point.
And that must enhance the differential between Ireland and Australia. The want in Australia and the urgency out of Ireland is magnifies the incentive.
It's unfortunately my duty to draw this session to a close. However, it's only towards the end of the first day, the third way through, and so I encourage you all to continue these kind of discussions and debate, and thank you so much, Eric, for stimulating us and for coming from the non-Irish colony of South Australia to talk to us about the Irish, because obviously that is another factor that we have to think about. There's no blanket statement like there were no Irish that went to South Australia, etc. So thanks very much, Eric.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.